Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I am the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology Sydney, and my producer is Anthony Dockrell, and a big thank you to him. In this edition, we are going to ask some tough questions of arguably the most popular person in Australian journalism. And he's not even really a journalist. He's a former journalist. These questions include, what do we make of the current parliamentary inquiry into press freedom, judging from its first few days of hearings? How would you go about spending $100 million to support journalism and journalists to do their job? And what are the biggest challenges facing Australian journalism today, and how do we fix them? There's going to be a lot, and there's going to be a huge plug at some point in this recording. So you have been warned. So who is this popular guy? Well, you might have guessed it. Welcome to the show, Mark Ryan.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
And for those of you who don't know, Mark Ryan is the director of the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas. He's a former journo and a fixer for Westfield Supremo Frank Lowy and the former Prime Minister Paul Keating. And before we get started, Mark, I did want to ask you a quick question about Paul Keating, because Paul Keating had some very robust ideas about journalists and journalism at times, and he wasn't at all shy about sharing those ideas. Did any of that rub off on you?
Inevitably. I was quite young when I went to work with Paul. I think I was in my mid-20s. I had come from working in the Victorian government. I ran the Victorian government media unit for a few years, so I wasn't exactly totally green, but certainly working for Paul did open my eyes to new ways of doing things, new techniques, if I could put it that way. And I think a lot, for those who did not experience Keating up close, in other words, if you were not a member of the Canberra Press Gallery, you could be forgiven for thinking he had quite a one-dimensional way of dealing with the media, which is far from the truth. He actually had a very sophisticated view of the media, and his starting point really was that to achieve the reforms he was setting out to achieve, he needed to bring the media with him. And he set about, even before he was in government, developing those relationships particularly with the doyens of the press gallery at that time. So people like Laurie Oakes, like Paul Kelly, like Michelle Grattan and others. And so he had very long-term, intimate and sometimes complicated relationships with those people, but nonetheless underlying the relationship, despite the ups and downs and the occasional conflict, there was, I think, an abiding respect between the two sides. I think the media, the press gallery, generally saw Keating for what he was and what he was trying to achieve, and knew that underneath it all, it was coming from, in a sense, a good place. It was well motivated. It wasn't aggression for aggression's sake. It wasn't trying to heavy journalists for the sake of having journalists. It was always in pursuit of a greater goal. And I think that was recognised by the media. But to answer your question, yes.
Just on that point, he didn't suffer fools easily.
No, he didn't.
But some of those fools were journalists.
He was famed and rightly so for getting stuck into journalists on a reasonably regular basis. But I can share one little anecdote that I haven't shared before. It was on one of my very first days in Keating's office. I was sitting there as a wide-eyed young press secretary, and Keating's habit was to wander into my office when he came into the office each day and look at the newspapers. And he asked me, mate, is there anything in the papers today? And I made the mistake of saying, oh, Michelle's done a column on X. So he quickly flicked through the pages to Michelle's column, read the column, went incandescent with rage, instructed me forthwith to get Michelle on the phone, which of course I did, handed the receiver to Paul, who then spent the next 35 to 40 minutes lambasting Michelle and pointing out all of her faults and so forth. He then slammed the receiver down, looked at me. I was ashen-faced, my jaw hitting on the desk. And he looked at me and waved his arm and with a laugh, and he said, don't worry about it, mate. She's got a hide as thick as an elephant.
And he was dead right.
And he was right. And it was a good introduction to the rough and tumble of Canberra media management in that sense. That is, the journos played it hard, but so did the politicians. And it wasn't only Keating. I think it was across the board.
It
was the rules of the game. It was the terms of engagement, and they were well understood. And yes, it could be very bruising at times, but it was a fantastic, just a fantastic school for me to come up in.
Were you, I don't want to dwell on this too long, but were you there to the bitter end, as it were?
Not the bitter end. I joined Paul, I think it was late 88, early 89, and left his office in 94.
Okay, not quite. Yeah, okay. Well, you had the sweetest victory.
It was great. It was a terrific time to be there. I often say I managed the concertina into half a dozen years, what felt like 12 or 15 years, because we had the tail end of the boom of the 80s. The recession, the leadership challenge with Bob Hawke, and then, of course, the winning the unwinnable election in 93. So there was a lot crammed, and then multiple state elections and other events in between times. So it was a terrific time to be there. And Paul was an incredibly generous boss. I mean, he was incredibly loyal and a terrific teacher.
Okay. Well, it served you in good stead, I think.
Yeah. It has.
For you, if you're listening and you don't know or you haven't heard about the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism, in essence, it's a Judith Nielsen is a Sydney-based philanthropist, most noted as a very long interest in art and Southeast Asia, and I think she gives money to anti-slavery campaigns as well, and I think urban architecture and various things. So she has a broad portfolio of interests. And about a year or so ago, it feels about a year or so ago, she announced that it was going to establish this fund, this $100 million, to support journalism and ideas, and which was a remarkable day. It was a fantastic day, and it's in my calendar. It was a great day. And up pops the guy who's going to run it, Mike Ryan. Was this a long time coming, wasn't it? You were on the project for quite some time.
Well, about 6 months prior to the project being announced, Peter, I was introduced to Judith in a very different context. I had been working with the Lowy family for nearly 25 years. Last year, the business, or the year before rather, the Westfield business was sold. So both I and a number of the other senior executives, that was an opportunity for us all to explore other opportunities, as they say. And I was introduced to Judith, not so much with this project in mind, but it came up in our early conversations, and I offered to think about this issue of what might be done to support journalism and do some research and talk to a lot of people and come back to Judith with some suggestions, recommendations. And Judith was very enthusiastic about that. I mean, fundamentally, I think Judith was looking to broaden the range of her philanthropic activities. As you've mentioned, she's involved in a number of cultural pursuits, architecture, and so on. And she wanted to deploy some of her funds to another endeavour. And she felt that journalism was something worth looking at.
Was there a prompt to that? Was there one thing?
I think, like all of us, she's a consumer of news, of course, like all of us, and she can see that the industry is going through a massive change. Mm-hmm. That the challenges facing those of us who are interested in receiving quality information, if I could put it that way, trustworthy, reliable, credible information, that all of that was under threat or under challenge. And I think if there was one single prompt, it was probably a visit that that Judith made to she was involved with a visit to refugees and saw their plight and saw some stories about how that particular issue was being reported, and it didn't square with what she was seeing.
There was this madness or something. Where did she go? Where were the refugees?
I think it was North Africa, somewhere around the Mediterranean.
Okay.
And I think if there was one single spur, that perhaps was it.
Interesting.
And Judith has said in the past on a number of occasions that from her point of view, there are many truths in the world. In other words, no story contains one single truth. There are many truths, and she was really interested in helping bring out these multiple truths.
No, it's a wise insight. There's no absolute truth, right?
That's it.
Yeah. She wasn't prompted by the election of Trump then?
Not to my knowledge. She has never raised the president with me in any discussion, so I guess not.
All right. Well, maybe at some other time. We're going to get back to JNIJ in a second. But the news of the week, much news of the week as always, but the one of the main events of the week in terms of journalism has been the first few days of the public hearings of the very long Parliamentary Joint Committee on Security and Intelligence hearings on press freedom. In fact, that's the shortened version of that committee. So that's the inquiry prompted by the recent raids on the home of the News Corp journalist Nika Smethurst and then the ABC the following day. And it really goes to the essence of this question. Have we got the balance right between press freedom and protecting our national security? Mark, you were at the first few days, or certainly I saw you there on Tuesday. I think you saw the Right to Know Coalition, which is the media bosses together, and then the ABC. What did you make of that hearing?
Well, I think the fact that it's happening is a good thing. That's the first point to make, as well as the Senate inquiry that's underway. And I guess the starting point for me is that we, this is not, others have made the point that we seem to be at a moment in time when it comes to press freedom and these issues. And I think that's true. And there has been something of a perfect storm in the last couple of months. Some of these issues, as you know, have been simmering for years. I mean, issues around defamation, issues around FOI, the difficulty, the obstacles governments have continually been putting in front of journalists who are oftentimes seeking just very basic and very mundane information. And you struggle to wonder why governments are working hard and spending taxpayers' money to protect that information or keep it under wraps. So these issues have been simmering, but then, as I say, I think there's been a perfect storm when you put together the so-called raids that occurred on the ABC and on News Corp, together with the inquiry into digital platforms that the ACCC conducted. And then on top of that, there are even lesser known or other inquiries that have been underway that have had less of a profile, looking at things like the deployment of soft power by Australia and the role that media plays or can play in that. So there's a number of these issues and inquiries have been swirling around, and I think the raids brought it to a head.
So you're a pretty astute observer of politics. So you know what's your feel? I mean, we can't look into the future, but what was your feeling having watched that committee in action? Of where this one's going to go? Do you think the government is in the mood to give?
I think it will go further than some of the cynics think it might. I think because there is now, and these other issues have not so much captured the public's imagination, because I realise it's not a kitchen table issue for most people. Nonetheless, it has certainly captured the attention and galvanised the media industry generally. And I think there's also a greater appreciation now of where Australia sits relative to the rest of the Western world and other democracies and the culture that we have here. I mean, somebody at the hearing yesterday described this as a wake-up call. I think it was Hugh Marks or maybe Michael Miller.
One of
those. It was a wake-up call. And that's right. And in a sense, I got my wake-up call about 2 years ago. I was at, as it happens, a media awards night, the Lowy Institute's award for foreign reporting. And I happened to be sitting next to Damien Cave, the New York Times reporter based here in Sydney, and he's been here now for 2 or 3 years. And he offered up to me, unsolicited, the view that Australia was the most secretive Western country he had ever visited or worked in.
And it's a remarkable thing for him to say, right?
Well, it took me aback because at that stage I wasn't as immersed in media issues as I am today. I hadn't done as much reading, and it did take me aback. And I said, you've got to be kidding me, surely. How prescient his words appear today. But he made the point, he was talking more, I think, about the culture, the fact that you can ring up a government department here and be stonewalled over the most ridiculous and mundane issues.
Right, which is so not what happens in the US, for instance.
No, there's more of a culture of openness. Yeah. And this has been a creeping development, I think. I don't think anybody in government, either state or federal, around the country over the past 30 years has set out in a conspiratorial way to bring this about. I think it's just been the FOI industry and governments, bureaucracies moving as they do more and more towards this culture, to the point where we're hung up about information that we don't need to be hung up about. Just get it out there. I think James Chessel from Nine Fairfax said yesterday that they'd been battling and spent tens of thousands of dollars to try and find out how much the New South Wales government spends on Vivid.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Now, why should that number not be out in the marketplace?
Absurd.
And who cares?
Well, exactly. So, look, we had the evidence in the last, today, in fact, saying the AFP saying it still might charge the News Corp journalist Anika Smith over the raids.
I think
we're getting to this point where journalists are going to be charged for, face charges.
That'll happen. I don't know. Obviously, none of us know the facts of the case and what's going on within the investigation, but I would be amazed if that were to occur. And I think also there needs, I can understand the level of concern in the media industry. Mm-hmm. I think it's right that the media industry has been galvanised and is pushing the system, pushing the government for reform, because I think reform is long overdue. At the same time, I also recognise, as something somewhat of an outsider, I do also recognise that the media can get, the hyperbole can get a little ahead of itself on some of these issues. I do not think that our democracy is under serious threat. I don't think the sky will fall in if serious reform doesn't happen, much as it's needed. And so I think some of the commentary from the media side can tend towards the being more colourful than it needs to be. And a lot of the straws that have gone on the camel's back over the past few years have come about not because government has, in a very deliberate, conscious way, gone in that direction. Oftentimes it's because of knuckleheaded decisions by individual police, by government bureaucrats and whatever. But the sum effect of it all, I mean, the issue...
Well, it goes to the culture though, doesn't it?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, the Adani example where I think it was the French journalists were arrested. Now, I didn't see the footage, but I'm fairly sure that that was just a bit of knuckleheaded decision-making on the ground by a particular policeman or whatever.
Fair point.
The reason I'm speaking like this is because I've had personal experience having worked in a major global company where you have thousands of employees, and it doesn't matter how many policies you have and how many guidelines and how many directives. In our case, we would still have the odd security guard who would overinterpret the guidelines, would take initiative where they should not take initiative, and so forth. So these things happen, but just throw them into the same, into the perfect storm that I described earlier. They all go to add to point to this culture.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Let's get back to JNIJ and that first round of grants which have been given out. A few basic questions. How much money you spent so far, and what gives you confidence that the money was well spent?
Well, it hasn't all been spent yet.
Yeah, I hope not.
and we have been incredibly conservative, Peter, in these early days.
So you haven't spent much at all, right?
No, not much at all.
Can you
not
give
much
me a ballpark?
At all. And I will in a minute, but okay. I need to explain first of all that. Firstly, when we sat down to think about how we might make grants to media generally, to journalism generally, the first signal that we wanted to send was that we were prepared to be incredibly open-minded and open to working with anybody and everybody. So at one end of the spectrum, what you might call the big end of town, we have developed partnerships with them. So News Corporation, The Guardian, the ABC, et cetera. But that spectrum continues all along down to a hyper-local news initiative in Warrnambool, Victoria.
The Terrier,
which we thought had a lot of things going for it and was as worthy of support as a bit of a test case, if you like, to see whether that particular model could take and get some traction as a and turn it into a going concern. So in between the big end of town and the Terrier in Warrnambool, we're supporting a podcast, we're supporting a community radio station in Roebourne, Western Australia. Some of our projects are focused offshore. They're international projects. Some of them are obviously focused domestically. We're working with The Herald and The Age on what we hope will be a really innovative series on Indigenous issues. So what we tried to do in the first round was just send a signal that we want to work with anybody and everybody and hope to work with more over time. And in terms of the amounts, what we've done with all of these first projects, we've basically signed a 12-month agreement with each of these organisations. Some of those agreements we have signed in the hope and expectation that they become multi-year commitments. And some of them are obvious ones. So, for example, we're working with the Financial Review to reopen their Jakarta Bureau. I certainly don't think of that as a 12-month project.
You're not going to get much done in 12 months.
No, we won't. But what I guess our philosophy is that we hope to, in these earlier days, provide an impetus. Mm-hmm. And then having created that impetus, provide sufficient support to get that idea and that initiative up and going so that it can then develop its own momentum, mm-hmm. perhaps develop other funding streams, and the Judith Nielsen Institute can then move on.
Can I ask the obvious question, and we will get back to the sum, but the obvious criticism is, why does Rupert Murdoch need dollars from Judith Nielsen? Those sorts of...
Rupert Murdoch doesn't, but his readers, the readers of The Australian and other News Corp publications and The Guardian and everybody else, their readers deserve quality journalism. And
but if it's a good idea, why don't they do it themselves?
Well, because you know better than I, newsrooms are strapped. Mm. I mean, the challenge I threw to the editors of all of the newspapers and the newsrooms generally around the country was, I understand you're cash-strapped, I know you're under pressure economically and staffing-wise and otherwise. What's on your wish list? What journalism do you think should be done but is not being done, and what can we do immediately to kickstart that? So, the other point to make, I guess, from the Judith Nielsen Institute's point of view is that we want to reach the biggest audience possible as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Impact. You want impact.
And whether it's News Corp or The Guardian or the mm-hmm. ABC, they have existing structures, platforms, and importantly, audiences that we can reach very quickly. So we won't be working exclusively with those sorts of people. As I've said, we'll work with a range of mm-hmm. others that perhaps on the face of it appear to be more deserving. But we are not a charitable institution in that we are set up to look after only what people perceive to be the most deserving. Our mission, broadly, is to support quality journalism. Mm-hmm. And because this industry is at such a is so volatile, it's probably at peak volatility right now. We are being very disciplined about not predicting where the future will go. We're not predicting how quality journalism will be delivered in a year's time, let alone 5 or 10 years' time. And so we want to remain nimble, flexible, open to ideas, open to partnering up with as many people as possible. And to this point about whether we should or shouldn't support big existing commercial operators, the fact is that globally, news organisations everywhere are collaborating more and more and more. And we want to be part of that. Australia's a little bit behind the game. America, as you know, mm-hmm. is far advanced in terms of the role that philanthropy plays in journalism. You now have the New York Times partnering up with ProPublica, Columbia School of Journalism.
Things happening at the BBC in the UK, all those sorts of things.
That's right. So I think people shouldn't be so hung up about whether or not we're supporting News Corporation or The Guardian and instead focus on the output. And hopefully the output will speak for itself.
Well, let's hope so. So just sticking on this a little bit, four of those first round of grants went to Indigenous reporting initiatives, I think, correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. So is that going to be a focus of JNIJ? And second point is, one of the criticisms of that was that even though the money went to Indigenous reporting, the money actually went into the hands of white fellas. So should it have gone into the hands of black fellas?
Well, not in every case.
You mean not in every case it went into the hands of...
No, I mean we're supporting the community radio station that we're supporting, okay, NADA Media in Western Australia. That's a direct payment. The Indigenous series that I mentioned with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, mm-hmm. my understanding is that Lisa Davies at The Herald will be hiring a young Indigenous reporter and photographer, okay. who will then work with the wider newsroom. The wider newsroom will mentor those young reporters and photographers to work on this project. And, you know, this. Remember, Peter, these are our first baby steps, as it were. We continue to meet with people. We met with First Nations, the umbrella media group, just this week. Mm-hmm. So those conversations will continue, and we'll learn as we go. And, you know, the challenge for us is to make impact. You know, it would be very easy for us to give lots of money away in dribs and drabs on worthy but low-impact projects.
You'd make a lot of people feel good, but you might not have the impact.
In the short term. Yeah. And you know, we will do short-term projects and we will do small projects, but in the long run, I think by dint of Judith Nielsen's generosity here, we can make a serious, meaningful impact in the long term, and that's really the bigger challenge for us.
Okay. Well, before we go any further, you better tell me how much you spent so far.
Well, it's hard to give you a black and white answer, but ballpark, let's call it a couple of $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
But that said, earlier I mentioned that we would, you know, we were hoping that some of these projects will become multi-year projects. So, for example, the Finn Review project to open the Jakarta Bureau, that's somewhere in the 300 to 500 range.
Yep.
So if we did that for 2 years or 3 years, it adds up.
But
again, it didn't make sense to rush out and spend multi-millions of dollars until we learn a bit more. Mm-hmm. Until we have more discussions, talk more, and learn as we go.
So on that point, I mean, you've done a lot of traveling, US, Europe, been all around, and obviously ran this country and New Zealand. Where do you see, I mean, this is a big question and maybe just take a couple of chunks at it, but what do you see as the major challenges for journalism? Is it the business model? Is it the content? Is it... Is it the digital platforms?
I think the business model.
Anywhere with it, can't
you? The business model, yes, is a challenge. But you know, that challenge started to emerge, I think, very starkly. You know, whatever 2005, 2006, I think people seem to say was the tipping point.
The classifieds.
And that changed in effect a 150-200 year business model, and what we're finding now is that. People are there. There's mass experimentation going on. Hybrid approaches are emerging all the time. Philanthropy combined with community-based support, combined with some commercial elements. So we're seeing a plethora of responses to the business challenge. I think the days of people thinking of the business challenge being solved with a silver bullet are gone. That's not going to happen. I mean, even mastheads like the New York Times and the Washington Post have somewhat different business models and approaches, and they're experimenting all the time. You know, the Times is getting into video content, doing deals with Hulu, and so on and so forth. So I think that this experimentation will continue apace. When I say we're at peak volatility, based on absolutely no scientific evidence whatsoever, I sense that we probably are there now and that things might just maybe, possibly, be about to settle a little.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it was only a few years ago people were predicting the demise of the New York Times, and look what's happened there. Mm. And even if you extract the so-called Trump bump that the Times seems to have enjoyed, it still seems to be somewhat successful. So,
but of course, a lot of newspapers, local newspapers in quite large cities, are under a lot of strain in the US and this country.
They are, and I think, you know, you talk about challenges for journalism. That's a huge one in Australia. The challenges facing regional media, and I think people are turning their minds to what possible solutions they are, and I think it will be horses for courses. What works for Warrnambool, Victoria, won't work for Newcastle or Townsville, and so on. Some markets will be more amenable to radio and television and vice versa. So there will be no neat cookie-cutter solution to regional journalism. I think it will take a lot more discussion, a lot of hard thinking. We need to see how the ownership changes shake out. As you know, Fairfax has just offloaded their regional portfolio. There's a lot of turmoil going on in the commercial broadcast area in regional Australia. That doesn't need to be all bad, the outcome of that. I in fact think that there'll be a lot of good will come out of that, and it has focused people's minds both in government and in the commercial sector and, in our case, philanthropy. as to what the solutions might be. And that's certainly on our agenda as to what role we might play in it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, because how do you see, for instance, so the Anthony Catalana Group buys 170-odd titles from Fairfax, a bargain price, an absolute bargain price, $150 million plus $10 million worth in advertising for a group that was valued less than a decade ago at $3.2 billion.
He's a good businessman.
He is a very good businessman. Do you see getting to bed with people like Catalano in a kind of holistic way,
but not just him. I mean, in the first instance, what I would like to do, what I need to do, is talk more to these people and maybe even convene a discussion with a number of them. We have McPherson Media, we have ACM with Catalano, you have the commercial broadcasters, and there are others I know. But and the Department of Communications people I know have been putting their minds to some of these issues as well from a policy point of view. And I think it would do the industry well to just take a breath and sit around a table and talk through some of these issues at a strategic level. There will always be and should always be the competitive urge. We should not be doing things that undercut that. But at the same time, I feel that there are many things that could be done where those sorts of people could get together and share resources and share ideas and collaborate in ways that that are good for everyone.
Okay. Let's talk about one of our favourite subjects on this show, which is digital platforms, Facebook in particular this time. So we've done the last two Fourth Estates on the digital platforms inquiry by the ACCC, and of course it's a wonderful listen. I'm going to plug my own show here, but this week we gained another kind of maybe a straw in the wind, a story in the Wall Street Journal which suggested that Facebook was moving towards some sort of content licensing deal with maybe the Journal, Bloomberg, ABC News, US that is, and there was even had a figure in it, $3 million. This, I'm assuming, there's a lot of supposition in this whole story, but I'm assuming that a similar thing would be happening here if it happens. What do you make of that? Is that just sort of, is that a good thing? Is that legit? Is it more guilt money from Facebook?
Well, whether it's a good thing or not, it's not really for me to say, and I certainly can't hold myself out as an expert in this sector. But it sounds like more of the same, in the sense that the scale, if what's been reported is accurate, the scale of it doesn't really suggest
it's not a lot of money.
No, it doesn't suggest that it's a game changer for either Facebook or for the media outlets. But you know, it's an experiment, and you never know where these experiments might lead. I think it's a little too simplistic to talk about what Google and Facebook do as guilt money. I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure, you know, in many cases these their expenditures in these areas come under their PR or marketing budget. But, look, it's money that's flowing into journalism. Mm-hmm. And who are we to scoff at that? So as long as, you know, safeguards are in place and the transparency is there and people know where the money's coming from, then that's a good thing.
Sure. What do you make of this, though? If Facebook suddenly has licensed all this content, so it's going to be, in essence, producing its own news section, so doesn't that make it a publisher, which is the one thing that they've been very much at pains to avoid being called?
Well, I'll just join the conga line of people that think that they should be called publishers.
You believe they should be called publishers?
Yeah, of course they should.
Yeah, interesting.
But why not? Why wouldn't
Judith Nielsen can give them some money if they become publishers.
Give Facebook? Well, you never know. Look, I've had very good, productive conversations with our friends at Google.
Yep.
We're not about to do a project with Google, but I wanted to learn more about what they were doing, and the anecdotal feedback I've had from some of the things they're doing under their Google News initiative have been very positive. So, you know, there's no point wishing them away. They are here.
No, I agree with you totally.
People use it, and if they want to participate in journalism and do it in a transparent way, then...
Yeah, so be it. I mean, I should add at this point that as the Center I co-director has received money from both Facebook and Google, as well as the government sector. And that one thing, just to finish on the ACCC, your submission, Judith Nielsen's submission to the ACCC inquiry, broadly said, hey, we need more different and new philanthropic ways of supporting journalism. In the final report, there was sort of a hint, well, not more than a hint, but it was one of the recommendations, so it was sort of didn't have a lot of detail to it. What do you want to happen in terms of that?
Well, I mean, I'm not qualified to get into the detailed legislative drafting, but, but fundamentally, it's very hard these days, as things stand, for people to give money to journalism and get a tax deduction. So you can give money to a range of other worthwhile causes and get a tax deduction, but not for journalism. And I think there is a creeping realization abroad that you know, perhaps journalism does play a fundamental, an important and fundamental role in our democracy.
Do you see that through the tax system, though, right? So
yeah.
the ACCC basically said, let's try and make it easier for journalism to get a charitable status.
Correct.
And you'd support that?
Absolutely, 100%. And, I mean, yes, there needs to be it needs to be ring-fenced, there needs to be a criteria set and so forth. But, you know, there are more complicated problems have been solved by government in the past, and I just think the time has come. You know, people, our politicians can't stand up on platforms on important occasions and make grandiose speeches about Australian democracy and how terrific we are unless they're prepared to support it in a meaningful way.
Fair
and this
point.
Is what this is one way they can do that.
So, Mike, there are some common misconceptions about Judith Nielsen, right? What do you get that's sort of not quite right?
In terms of the Institute, some people think that have the idea that we're a grant making organisation in the traditional sense, that we will have an annual round of applications and we will sift through those applications and make decisions about who we might provide funding to. That's not the way that we're approaching this. We are much more assertive. We will not have an annual grants program. It will be an ongoing process. Some of the ideas we think we will generate within the Institute. Other ideas, yes, they'll come to us unsolicited, and others will be a meeting of minds in conversations that we have with people in the media. But it's a matter of us, we and the industry collectively coming up with great ideas and then sitting down and working out how we can improve on those ideas before we make a decision to fund something. So it's not a passive.
It's an iterative thing.
It's iterative. It's not a passive process. It won't have lengthy guidelines and lengthy forms to fill in. It'll be a much more informal, ongoing process where the Institute will seek to play quite an assertive role in determining where its funding goes.
So very much unlike, I think, to my mind, any other kind of grant process that exists, both government and non-government.
That's correct. I mean, and they tend to, but they do over time ossify. They become very cumbersome. They're administratively very difficult to operate, and they're not nimble. We want to be able to be flexible and move quickly, and when good ideas come up, leap on them quickly and make them happen. So, so that's the philosophy we're bringing to it.
Fair point. Well, talking about things, supporting things. If you had been watching SBS the last few nights and weeks, you would have seen a great advertisement for a new event coming on in the Sydney Opera House, and I think this is your free plug. It's called the Antidote. What's your involvement with that?
I'm glad you asked me this difficult question, Peter.
Yeah, it's a very tough question.
I should actually go back to first principles. The Judith Nielsen Institute will do three things fundamentally in its early years. One, we will make grants to get quality journalism done, and we've spoken about that. Secondly, we've done some very detailed work on what we might be able to do to support the ongoing professional development of journalists. So not so much student journalists, but mid-career journalists.
That's where the gap is.
And, I mean, just one example of where we might be able to help there is that the work we've done has shown that the very, very best courses or materials, educational opportunities for mid-career journos occur offshore. They're very expensive for Australian journalists to access. They're logistically difficult for Australians to access. And
so you mean offshore? You mean in the US?
In the US and Europe and, yep. and beyond. And we may be able to play a role in...
You're going to make one here.
Well, I think we could potentially collaborate with some of those providers offshore mm-hmm. and sit with them and see whether we can craft something that was meaningful for Australian journalists and help bring them to Australia and so make it easier.
We're talking about Colombia, those sorts of places.
Well, Colombia would be one, but there are others. You know, people that are now looking at things like data mining, mm-hmm. open source journalism, you know, those sorts of things. You know, to bring, I mean, part of what we want to do at the Judith Nielsen Institute is to bring Australian journalists, provide opportunities for them to go out into the world, but also to bring the world to Australia. And in that education space, I think we can do it. So grants, yep. education, thirdly, events, which brings me to the Antidote Festival at the Sydney Opera House. I mean, this is just a wonderful opportunity for us in our very early days to promote ourselves, basically.
Mm. When is it on? It's on September, isn't it?
Yeah, it's on the 1st of September, Sunday the 1st of September. Mm-hmm. We are the co-presenter of the festival. We have... curated three of the sessions, and each of those will have a focus on journalism. We're using this opportunity to bring to Australia our International Advisory Council, which includes some of the most senior and most highly respected journalists from around the world. Some of those will actually participate in the festival. So it's just a terrific opportunity on the most iconic platform in Australia, the Opera House, to promote ourselves and to get people focused on and talking about these issues. And in fact, one of the sessions that we have that we'll be hosting is called My Crime is Journalism. Mm-hmm. And it will go to the very issues we were talking earlier, about press freedom and the role of journalists in society.
We're going to talk to about one of my favourite journalists, Maria Ressa.
Correct, yeah. Maria Ressa will be here. Steve Cole, who's one of the most outstanding journalists and authors in the world, now currently the Dean of the Columbia School, will be here, and a host of others. So it's just a terrific opportunity for us to bring people from around the world to Sydney and involve them in our work.
Do we get tickets on the JNIJ website or the Sydney Opera House?
There's a link there, but if you go to the Sydney Opera House Antidote website, you'll be able to get tickets there.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but I have one very broad question. So let's pretend we're going to meet again in a year's time, and we're going to talk about the Judith Nielsen Institute of Journalism and what's happened in this year. Paint me a picture.
Well, we'll be able to talk in far greater detail about what has been produced, for a start. So those projects were in Jakarta, in the Pacific, the Indigenous program, the community radio program in WA, we'll be able to tell you how they've gone, what worked and what didn't work, because not everything will go according to plan. It never does. But what I hope to be able to at least foreshadow in 12 months' time, Peter, is perhaps the way we're thinking about some larger projects, because what I've described in terms of the grants and the education programs that we talked about, they will be our kind of, if you like, routine mm-hmm. core business. There'll be a portfolio of activity that will be continually refreshed and renewed or extended. That'll be our day-to-day job. The big challenge that we have over the next couple of years is to really think deeply about what can make a meaningful impact. You know, what are the perhaps two, possibly three big ideas that we can get involved in? Mm. Those will probably involve us collaborating with others, both here and around the world. But nonetheless, it's a great challenge to have, but it's also a very difficult one in this volatile market that we're talking about. So we have the opportunity to make a real statement here for journalism, but also for Australia. I think we can do something truly unique at the Judith Nielsen Institute that will get it recognised globally. And hopefully, if we might not have that bedded down in 12 months, but we may be able to at least flag some of our thinking at that time.
Okay, well, that's a diary date. I will see you, Mark Ryan, in a year's time. I'll probably see you next week, knowing the number of times we run into each other. But Mark, thank you, the head of the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas. I like the ideas bit as well. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Peter.
That's about it for this week, but make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media and politics and a few things in between at your leisure. And we'll be back at the same time next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. And big thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name is Peter Frey, and thanks very much for listening.